evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan says now the international donors have stepped up. It is President Kiir's and Riek's turn to make good on their promises.
We need to hold the leadership to the agreements that they've signed. It's important for the people of South Sudan that the fighting stops.
And more deaths are reported in South Sudan cholera outbreak.
Situation that requires a very dramatic action from everyone who understands the levels of suffering in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan says now the international donor community has made pledges of more than $600 million to help the people of South Sudan. It's time for the government and the opposition to keep their commitments. He says they must allow aid to be delivered to everyone who has been affected by the fighting, regardless of which side they are on. Andrew Green has more for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at the close of the Oslo Donors Conference, Special Envoy Donald Booth says it is time the warring parties stop fighting and allow food, water, and emergency supplies to reach the hundreds of thousands of people who need it.
We need to hold the leadership to the agreements that they've signed. It's important for the people of South Sudan that the fighting stop so that not only can humanitarian assistance come through, but so that the confidence to begin to address the political issues underlying the conflict, that those talks can proceed.
Booth says the next step is to deploy regional troops to monitor a cessation of hostilities agreement and guarantee that the entire country is open to aid workers.
The monitors will be able to go out and be able to explain to the entire world exactly who is responsible. And then, as we've heard today, in terms of those who obstruct delivery of humanitarian assistance, the same for those who violate the cessation of hostilities agreements, there will be consequences for them. So we need to get the monitors out there. We need to ensure they can operate in a safe environment. And I think this will do a lot to make a reality out of the agreements that have been signed.
Officials with the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, a regional body that is providing the monitors, says their mission has been delayed as they wait for the troops to arrive. There is still no date set for the arrival of the additional forces. Foreign Affairs Minister Barnaba Marial Benjamin says his government will live up to its end of the bargain.
The government and the President of the Republic is on record that they will be given easy delivery of food. You also know there is fighting in the area, and these agencies, their security is important. So they will need to coordinate with government so that they are warned ahead of time, so that they don't go into areas where they might meet some instability.
Opposition officials were not available for comment after Booth's presentation at the conference, but said earlier in Oslo that they were also committed to helping to ensure that humanitarian aid reaches as many people as possible. The United Nations estimates 4 million people face alarming food insecurity in South Sudan due to the fighting that raged for 5 months across the country after a political argument between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar turned violent. For VOA News, I am Andrew Green.
That report was prepared by Philippa Leu, who covered the conference in Oslo, Norway. We would like to remind our listeners that the funds for this program are provided by the Office of the Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Although the amount of money pledged at the just-concluded donor conference in Oslo, Norway, surpassed $600 million, it fell far short of the $1.8 billion United Nations goal for South Sudan. The head of the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance in Juba tells VOA fellow Nabil Biagio that the pledges will only meet 60% of the people of the need of the people in South Sudan who are suffering right now.
A situation that requires a very dramatic action from everyone who understands the levels of suffering in South Sudan.
What should be the priority in spending the $600 million pledged?
There are specific priorities in food. The populations have been displaced away from their homes. They have not been able to produce food they need. Their livestock is unable to be cared for. And up to 1.3 million people have moved away from their homes. These populations require immediate assistance, and the resources that were obtained will help provide food for the population that has been displaced. Many of them also have had children who are severely malnourished because their mothers cannot take care of them. So nutritional supplements will be extremely important for children, and these funds will go into that. These resources will also provide for health assistance. Many of the individuals affected have had no health assistance. The health facilities were severely damaged. They lack medical supplies. Health officers are not in their posts to provide health services. There are several communicable diseases that need attention immediately. And so these funds will be able to provide for the families in need of assistance in health. Many individuals also have fled their homes and require shelter. They are staying in the open. They do not have household material. They need everything to survive from the open elements, particularly when the rains come.
Is the amount pledged, that's the $600 million, enough to meet the urgent needs of civilians in South Sudan?
For the very basic requirement, we need $1.8 billion. $1.8 billion. And we had already gotten about 530. This contribution, therefore, brings the total contribution to just a little over $1.1 billion, equivalent to just about 60% of our need. We live in a world of optimism, even in these exceptionally challenging financial times. And since we are in May, we look forward to donors considering in the remaining months of 2014 to contribute so that the remaining 40% gap will be filled. For now, we will demonstrate that every dollar they have contributed is doing extremely important work in saving lives and protecting the dignity of those whose dignity has been severely tampered with.
What should be done to make sure aid reaches those in need?
We are aggressively engaging with all parties, whether the government of South Sudan or the opposition or any persons that have influence in making a difference in enabling humanitarians to reach areas where the populations are stuck and are suffering, and enabling also populations to be reached by them being known where they are.
That's Vincent Lilley, head of UN OCHA in Juba. He was speaking with VOA fellow Nabil Biagio from Juba earlier today. With us in the studio is Brian Badi Dimas, the executive director of Mundri Relief and Development Association, a local non-governmental organization operating in Western Equatoria State. Brian says the donor community has for the most part ignored the humanitarian needs of people in the greater Equatoria State. Brian, welcome to South Sudan in Focus. Let's just start by asking you, what are you doing in the United States?
Thanks very much, John. I was invited by Voices for Sudan and because they wanted to know what the situation is in South Sudan, and that's why I'm here.
And why do you think donors have forgotten Eastern, Central, and Western Equatoria?
Well, we really appreciate the effort for relief, emergency relief. That is very necessary because of the conditions of the people at the moment. But I thought two things could happen at the same time. Now, relief has taken off all the attention and development has been forgotten. But when this crisis end up, then we will need still the country has to tick, the country has to survive, and that needs development. So I think areas like Greater Equatoria, where there is still peace, relative peace, I think we should not abandon economic activities or developmental activities, and then just everybody rushes to relief.
And what are some of the problems facing people in the areas that you've just mentioned?
Well, there are lots of problems. Problems of poverty. They are a wide spectrum of things. There is no water in certain places, schools, there is a need for health services, there is a need for medicine, and all that kind of thing which you know. And I think that we need to continue to give those services, and we need to continue to empower the people so that they can stand on their feet, so that when relief is over and the whole country is back to peace, then we can move forward. But if we forget development now and we all go just to the relief aspect, then by the time we come back, a lot of time will have elapsed.
But
South Sudan really is lagging behind. This is about 9 years from 2005. And I think we are playing a catch-up game. So we must be fast.
But a lot of aid agencies are saying the situation in Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity State is really, really bad. And that's why the international community wants to rescue people who are there.
Absolutely. I have no disagreement with that. We want to rescue people. We want them to have food. We want them to have access to water. That nobody can argue against. But I'm only saying that some of the money that used to go to development should still go. And I think there is a possibility that development can go alongside the relief effort.
And development experts are saying most African countries are suffering from what they call donor dependence syndrome. Do you agree with that?
Well, I partly agree in that, you know, the world has so many problems in every part of the world. And that's why maybe donors are not having enough money. And that's why they talk about this syndrome. Particularly, if you are given some help, then it is expected you should make best use of that help so that next time it can go to someone else. But like in our case, every now and then we are in problems and we are coming back to relief. That, I think, may discourage some people.
And they're saying you people who are running non-governmental organizations in places like South Sudan have given a notion to do the local people to really depend on World Food Program, depend on other agencies to help them, as opposed to their traditional means of survival.
I think we need to do a lot more. We really do need to do a lot more to try and reorient the minds of the people. You know that our people they depend on extended families, and this actually plays into the hand of the relief or the aid.
Yes. Let me just ask you one question. What are you doing to help the people of Western Equatoria help themselves?
We are doing a lot of things. First of all, we're giving small credits to women and others in order to help them in their agriculture. We have recently got oxen and plowing system, which is in place, and we are teaching, educating the farmers, showing them how to use this in order to expand their output of the, you know.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for being with us here, and we wish you all the best in what you're doing to help people in South Sudan. Brian Badi Dimas is the Executive Director of Mundri Relief and Rehabilitation Association. Thanks for joining us today here in Washington Studio.
Thank you.
Less than a week after the World Health Organization and government officials announced a cholera outbreak in South Sudan, health officials now say 13 people have died in Juba alone. They say more than 260 others have contracted the disease. UNICEF's emergency health specialist, Claudia Vivas, tells my colleague in Juba, Charlton Doki, what the UN is doing to try to stop the spread of the deadly disease.
Well, according to the latest figures from the Ministry of Health of South Sudan, we have so far 266 cumulative cases and also 13 deaths, being six of them in the health facilities and seven outside in the community. There are not confirmations of cases outside of Juba. So I think for that we wait the official report from the Ministry of Health.
How does this outbreak particularly affect children?
It is affecting children very much and also the mothers. The problem that we are having is a preventable disease, but if it's not treated correctly and timely, children can get dehydration very easy. So UNICEF for that is preventing giving key messages and also ensuring all children that are affected are getting oral rehydration salts on time for dehydration.
How would you describe the response so far to the outbreak?
UNICEF is supporting the national authorities, the Ministry of Health, and working together with other UN agencies and also implementing partners like NGOs. We are working in the three different sectors that are most affected: health, water and sanitation, and also social mobilization. So in health, we are focusing on case management. We are supporting directly the Juba Teaching Hospital in setting up the cholera treatment center, structurally and also functionally. Structurally, we have provided tents for ensure that there is triage, that there are also supplies related to health, like drugs, and especially diarrheal disease kits that normally help for treating patients that are severe affected and also moderate. But most importantly, we are also working on prevention within the health facilities and at the communities. We are providing key messages for the whole population, like, for example, only drink safe water, prepare food safely, protect your children and be careful how you are feeding them, always use the latrine and the toilet, wash your hands with soap, if available, and keep environment clean, and overall stay hydrated. For children, this last one is very important because we need to ensure that the oral rehydration salts are given properly within the health facility and also at the community level for preventing dehydration. We are not just responding to the outbreak here in Juba, but we are also preparing other states in the rest of the country.
People who haven't yet contracted cholera, what else can they do?
Well, people need to recognize what are the signs and symptoms, as I explained before, to ensure they are not dehydrated. But besides that, we should ensure also that water and sanitation are safe. And for that, UNICEF is supporting in the water quality and monitoring together with chlorination, as well as drinking water. Specifically, we have been supporting the functioning of the cholera treatment center here in Juba, teaching hospital, but also we have been training quality monitors for water all over Juba, together with the city council and also the Juba Urban Water. We have also been providing supplies at community level like chloril, megaphone, and also keeping the camps clean and also providing latrines that are elevated.
Do you have any specific concerns about the timing of this outbreak, you know, given that there is a conflict going on in the country?
Well, there is a conflict, but also rainy season is approaching, if not already here, meaning that vulnerable population, especially children, will be more affected because of the sanitation conditions that we are having.
What do you see as some of the challenges in trying to contain the outbreak?
I think the challenge is to ensure that the whole population is aware of the situation and that we have the capacity for responding to the needs. In this sense, also UNICEF is working together with partners, spreading the messages around the community and preparing with training within Juba and also in the States on how to prevent cholera, but also how to treat it and how to manage the cases.
That was Claudia Vivas, UNICEF's emergency health specialist in South Sudan, speaking to Charlton Doki in Juba earlier today.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Drinking fluids during hot weather is important for your health. It's best to drink clean water, milk or fruit juice to avoid dehydration. Drinking alcohol will not help you and can cause problems. Consuming a lot of beer, wine or other alcoholic beverages can leave a person dehydrated, confused, and susceptible to injury. The signs of dehydration are dry lips and tongue, headache, or even dizziness. If fluids aren't replaced quickly, heat stroke or even heart problems can follow. So make sure you drink a lot of fluids, especially clean water.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we talk to James Copnall, the author of a new book on South Sudan, who takes a closer look at Sudan and South Sudan relations. Stay tuned.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus, and there are now a number of options for listening. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country. Check out our website, voanews.com/South Sudan, for the listings. In Juba, you can listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5, VOA's 24-hour station. You can also find us on the following shortwave frequencies, 11620, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or you can listen on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan. You can also download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think more education can solve the problem of unemployment?
I think so. I mean, because if you look at other countries, I mean, with massive education, a lot of people have been able to provide job opportunities for themselves. If you have a good number of people that are educated in a country, they will be able to provide job for themselves rather than depending on the government.
Not certainly, because we have very many people who are educated on the streets. They do not have jobs. So many of the people who are robbing and doing some other funny stuff are very educated people. So it's not only education, it's job creation and making sure that the people who are educated are absorbed and are absorbed relevantly in relevant areas that they studied in.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has warned that the United States could impose tougher sanctions on Russia if it undermines Ukraine's elections on May 25th. Biden spoke of potentially imposing greater costs, quote-unquote, on Russia after speaking with Romanian President Traian Băsescu in Bucharest today. The vice president arrived in Bucharest yesterday as part of the Obama administration's campaign to reassure NATO allies of strong U.S. support. Suspected Islamist militants have killed nearly 30 people in two villages near Chibok, the northern Nigerian town where hundreds of schoolgirls were kidnapped last month. Witnesses in Alagarno say gunmen stormed their village overnight and killed at least 17 people. They say the attackers also stole food and set homes on fire. Residents in nearby Shawa say gunmen killed at least 10 people during a Monday attack. And finally, Pakistan's military says airstrikes have killed at least 60 militants in the country's northwest tribal region. The military issued a statement saying hardcore terrorists, including some of the important commanders and foreigners, were among those killed in the strikes in North Waziristan. It said around 30 militants were wounded and arms and ammunition were destroyed. A reporter for The Voice of America says the military targeted hideouts in Mir Ali and Mirin Shah near the Afghan border. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
The relationship between the people of Sudan and South Sudan has been problematic before and even after South Sudan declared its independence in July 2011. Leaders from Sudan and South Sudan have yet to agree on many issues related to the separation, including the contested Abyei region. James Copnall is a freelance correspondent who worked for the BBC in Sudan and South Sudan. He has just written a book entitled A Poisonous Thorn in Our Flesh, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter Incomplete Divorce. James, welcome to South Sudan in Focus.
Pleasure to be here.
First of all, tell me a little bit about the meaning behind the title of your book.
Yeah, A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts. Look, this was a quote from Tayeb Mustafa, who is Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir's uncle. And in a rather unpleasant way, he was describing the South Sudanese as a poisonous thorn in the hearts of the Sudanese. Now, that's not a description that a lot of Sudanese would agree with. There were clearly good relations in some cases between Sudanese and South Sudanese, as well as the bad. But I chose this title because it reflected a reality in the first couple of years after the separation that the Sudanese and South Sudanese governments did a lot against each other. There was a lot of antagonism between Juba and Khartoum.
Right.
Both sides sponsored each other's rebel groups. There was economic war largely over oil, and of course the clashes over the Hejlij or Panfow oil field. So in many ways that antagonism continued after the split.
And you're here in the United States definitely to talk about this book to a lot of people. What is the central theme of your book?
I think it's two, really. The first is that those ties between Sudan and South Sudan continued after separation. And that means that a good relationship between Khartoum and Juba can do an awful lot for the peoples of both countries. Now, that involves essentially a better term between the government in Khartoum, the government in Juba, and that did start to happen after the September agreements of 2012, because the alternative is pretty bad. It's conflict about the borders and on the borders, it's sponsoring rebel groups, it's economic warfare over oil, and that's and trade as well, which is a massive thing for the people of the Tamazuj or intermingling area on the borders. That's very bad for the peoples of both countries. The second message is that even if the relationship between the two Sudans get better, governance in both countries has to improve. Otherwise, we see the disastrous things like the civil wars in Darfur, South Kordofan and Blue Nile in Sudan, but also the terrible events we're witnessing in South Sudan at the moment.
Yeah, you spend most of your time interacting with both politicians and the ordinary people in the two Sudans. What are some of your memorable moments?
Well, there were lots, I think. I was twice in places as they were bombed by Sudanese airplanes, and to see the things that many South Sudanese and Sudanese citizens have had to experience in the Nuba Mountains or in Darfur and South Sudan was a distressing experience. I remember, too, speaking to victims of inter-ethnic violence in Jonglei, including one woman who had been shot herself, though she survived. 10 members of her family had been killed, and her 3-year-old child had been snatched from her in front of her eyes. And she felt this was normal. This is what happened in her part of the world. And her family would take revenge, and that cycle would continue. And that was an extremely depressing point. But also moments of great optimism, too, by meeting brilliant Sudanese and South Sudanese who had positive things to try and develop their nation in both countries, really. And that's the moment of optimism. It doesn't come from the politics of both countries. It comes from the people.
Yeah, let me pick your brain on the politics that comes from the people. A lot of Sudanese are saying the reunification of Sudan is possible. What is your say on that?
This is a Sudanese perspective. I don't think it's one shared by the South Sudanese. There's a certain intelligent group of Sudanese people who very much regret the separation of South Sudan, because for them it's the end of a dream of a certain cosmopolitan Sudanese identity. But I think if you ask the South Sudanese, certainly at separation, 99% voted for separation. But even with the current troubles we're seeing in South Sudan, I feel the South Sudanese want to be independent. They deserve their own country because that's their wish, just as Scotland has the right to separate from the United Kingdom in their upcoming referendum. So although certain Sudanese, particularly intellectuals, would like to see the country reunited, I don't see that as a realistic prospect. South Sudan is independent and wants to be independent.
And a lot of the international media has been accused of using buzzwords that come from the international aid agencies. And these words sometimes scare people. Let me just give example of some of these words. They say, for instance, some headlines would say South Sudan has the worst mortality rate in the world. Oh, South Sudan has the highest rate of child labor in the world. Are they true? What is the motivation behind some of these headlines?
I haven't heard the one about child labor. I've seen that figure about the highest rate of child mortality. I think establishing accurate statistics is difficult, but certainly it seems true that there was a problem of maternal mortality in South Sudan, and people shouldn't shy away from reporting that if true.
James, thank you very much, and this is all the time we had for you. That was James Cupnall, a freelance correspondent who worked for the BBC in Sudan and South Sudan. He has just written a book, A Poisonous Thorn in Our Flesh, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter Incomplete Divorce. That's all we have for you today. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.